everyone. Welcome to the Dynamic World session. Looks like we could have gotten a slightly bigger room, so thanks for accommodating. I think there's one seat in the corner over there, or feel free to come up to the front or the back and get a little comfy. It looks like it still isn't presenting on the screen, if I could have Jermaine. Sorry, we thought we were good. Give us one more second. Ah, excellent. All right. So over a year ago, we launched with WRI, Elise up front here, and Fred Stoll and Craig Hansen at WRI, a number of others. We launched we released a novel data product called Dynamic World. And our motivation for the product was that ecosystems are dynamic. And our data sets, our data products, we need monitoring that is as dynamic as they are. So Dynamic World is the biggest non-observational data set that humans have ever produced thanks to AI. Right now, it's 13.2 petabytes. It's up from, you know, about 9 petabytes a year ago. And we added 3.4 petabytes since launch. It's 12.7 million assets, up from 10.2 million assets on Sentinel-2 scene, you know, over Sentinel-2 scenes, over the entire catalog. And it continues to be in our top 10 of the most popular data sets used in Earth Engine in the data catalog. So Dynamic World offers these land cover data closer to the actual cadence of the image acquisitions and probabilistic labels that provide greater flexibility for users than a single categorical label. And advancements in AI have allowed us to run this model over every single S2 scene that is not too cloudy, creating this parallel collection of land cover data. So for this past year, we've been learning more and more about the neural time outputs, and we've also led a number of trainings and workshops from AGU to one a few weeks ago that you're going to hear about momentarily. But most of all, we'll continue to be excited about the ability of scientists, you all, to take Dynamic World and further refine it and customize it. And so for an example of that, I'm going to hand it over to Ujjwal Gandhi of Spatial Thoughts and Elise Mazur of WRI. And just a quick note on the logistics of today. We have we're going to hear first from Ujjwal Gandhi and Elise, and then we'll hear from three other speakers and examples of how they've been using Dynamic World for impact. We'll have 10 minutes of Q&A at the end, so please hold your questions till the very end. And then I'll give a pointer to Valerie's session on Cloud Score at the very end. Okay, so Ujjwal and Elise, over to you.
Hey everyone, I'm Elise Mazur. As Tanya said, I work at the World Resources Institute on the Land and Carbon Lab.
I'm Ujjwal Gandhi. I run a training academy called Spatial Thoughts.
Like 2 or 3 weeks ago now, Ujjwal and I went to Nairobi and we held a Dynamic World Mapathon. We really wanted to see how quickly people could pick up using Google Earth Engine and Dynamic World and see what they could use it for. So we partnered with the Regional Center for Mapping of Resources for Development, or RCMRD, who are based in Nairobi. And we invited a bunch of folks from their organization, from local and national government agencies, from NGOs, from professors and students from universities. And we all came together to explore Dynamic World together.
This was structured as a hybrid workshop come hackathon. We really wanted people to apply Dynamic World to solve their problems. But we had a mixed audience. Some people knew Earth Engine. Some people didn't know coding at all or know Earth Engine. None of them knew about Dynamic World. So we structured this as a 5-day event where for the first 4 days in the morning, we were teaching them Earth Engine coding and using Dynamic World. And then in the afternoons, they would work on group projects. And they would keep building and applying the skills they learned to the project. And on the 5th day, they would present their work. The structure worked surprisingly well. We taught them about change detection, supervised classification, time series processing, and building apps. And all the groups were able to pick up and apply those skills. And we saw some really interesting applications of Dynamic World to the problems. We had a lot of great ideas. The team self-formed. We had brainstorming sessions, and people kind of thought about what they would do with Dynamic World, with their expertise and interest that they had. And we had kind of 7 projects that came along, and we had groups that worked on it. There was a lot of interest in crop monitoring, crop type monitoring. There was interest in urban sprawl. There was interest in forest loss. And on the 5th day, we had the team present their work. All of them built apps. They solved the problems. They showed their work. And we had a panel. We kind of judged them on all their work. And I want to present the work of the top 2 teams. We had 2 teams that kind of shone out and did really great work. So we'll talk about these 2 projects.
Yeah, so our winning group worked on mapping the effects of restoration efforts in the Maasai Mara Forest in Kenya. So this group was comprised of folks from the Kenya Forest Service, from the Kenya Water Towers, from RCMRD, and some other groups. So the Maasai Mara Forest is a forest complex that is being degraded and cleared for timber, for agriculture, and for expanding settlements. So all these groups that worked on this project are actively working with the community to help restore the land via tree planting. You can see that they do aerial seeding, they do like manual tree planting, and so this week they wanted to use Dynamic World to monitor that restoration by using local training points to kind of reclassify Dynamic World.
They did a lot of work. They wanted to see the changes in the region that they were doing. I want to focus on the classification part, where they wanted to actually get a land cover change product, where they want to see how the land cover has changed in the forest, and can you see the effect of a restoration in their work. They started with just visualizing the Sentinel-2 composite for the region. This is the region of the forest. Most of the changes happen in this part of the region. Just the visual representation shows you some greening effect. There was a cropland that's being kind of restored, and there's grass now and forest regrowing. You can see some of the greening effect, but to quantify and really see it, you would need the land cover. So they started looking at Dynamic World, and Dynamic World gives you this top 1 class probability. What's the probability of the highest class that the model is predicting? And if you just loaded this, this is what you saw. And it was great having people who actually worked on this project, and they would say, oh, this is wrong. There's no forest there. Right? The Dynamic World says this is a top probability of this pixel is a forest. I said, no, this is not a forest there. This is a grassland there. I know. I planted the tree there. Right? So again, they knew about this, and they said, this is, you know, not right. But again, that's the beauty of land cover product from Dynamic World. It gives you the probability of the models that you can use to further refine the model to suit your local needs. This is a global model. It did okay being a global model in this context, but the context of this forest is very different than what the model has learned. But you can, with your own training data, you can refine this. So that's what they did. They took the probability bands of Dynamic World and trained it to classify into 3 classes. They say, we'll classify this region into crops, grass, and trees. And this is what they saw. On the left side is the before, where you can see all the pink stuff. This is cropland. And on the after, just a few years later, after all the effort, you can see the grassland and the forest regrowing. And they saw, once they got this map, they said, this is the most accurate representation of the map that we have seen. And this really matches what we see on the ground there. So this is like a good testament to, with just a few training samples and refining Dynamic World, they could get a pretty accurate product that matches the ground reality. They also built an app that showed, you can explore and show the changes there. So here on the left side, you see the before and the effect of the classification on the after. And you can see where the actual changes occurred.
So the runner-up project was working on mapping the surface water extent of this Lake Nakuru. This is a lake that has been expanding beyond its boundaries, and it's been submerging park infrastructure, it's been submerging forest and biodiversity, and it's threatening the surrounding towns. So the monitoring objective for this week was to classify the water in this lake over time, so from 2015 through 2022, to see the change in area.
And this was also in top of mind for many people. Like, there were 2 separate groups. They were like, we want to monitor this lake, and this is part of the biodiversity and also the tourist attraction. So they really wanted to understand what's happening here. Here, when the team started looking at the project, they took the Dynamic World probability bands, tried to reclassify and detect water. What they found was what many users who start using Dynamic World, they find out that Dynamic World is a more generalized product. It has got a spatial context, so it misses the fine-grained features. So there were a lot of small water bodies, small areas that it missed. It wasn't able to classify it. So they said, what do we do? Well, the right mental model to think about Dynamic World is not a land cover product, but think about your surface reflectance bands of Sentinel-2. You now have 9 additional bands that you can use along with your Sentinel-2 surface reflectance bands to give you additional information. So you take your Sentinel-2 scene, stack the probability bands from Dynamic World, and now you have this rich set of information that your model can learn from. So by combining the Sentinel-2 scenes with the Dynamic World probability bands, they were able to classify it, and you get best of both worlds. It was able to recover the fine-grained details, but the advantage of Dynamic World is it's much more accurate. It's an output of a model, so it is less noise. So, and then they could do this for every year, and you could see the changes in the surface water extent. They could determine there's 8 square kilometers of increased surface water that has happened over this period of time. Again, the team was very ambitious. They said, can we do this for entire Kenya? We want to monitor this and give people in the hands of people. They built this prototype app where you can select the lake. They did it for one more lake of interest, and you can select the 2 years and compare, and you can see the chart of the surface water changes there. And again, this is the Lake Nakuru. You can see on the left the before, and you can see the increased extent on the right, how the lake has been expanding. And again, this showed that people were able to build this app and kind of get it in the hands of people that would really need to monitor that. Our kind of key takeaway from kind of seeing this work and seeing all the projects was that Dynamic World gives you this way to get to an accurate local land cover product much quicker with less training data than you would need to do it. Right? So it gets you to that point much quicker, and you could build a locally relevant land cover product much faster. Again, you can get best of both worlds. You don't have to use Dynamic World by itself. You can combine it with the Sentinel-2 bands to get the land cover probabilities along with the reflectance bands. And Earth Engine apps are great. I think this we saw in kind of real time how powerful the apps platform is for the Earth Engine. People were able to learn. People who never coded before, they could build apps that you saw. And it really helps to communicate your results and share the results with people. So I hope by seeing this inspires you to give Dynamic World another chance. And you can try this out and let us know how you apply Dynamic World to your product.
I'm just going to switch gears really quickly. I'm not sure where we're at on time, but okay. So we've also been exploring what validation means for Dynamic World. So Dynamic World is a near real-time land cover product with land cover probabilities, not just a single class, right? So we've been testing a few different approaches on how do we validate this, what does that mean? But before I dive into any of those, the most important is that however you take Dynamic World and alter it with local data or however you're applying it, that's the map that really needs to be validated, and that's what's important. In the original paper, you can see that we validated with a chunk of the tiles that were visually inspected. They were polygons. They were compared to Dynamic World predictions from the same date as those labeled tiles. And depending on how we selected data or how we selected the tiles and whether there was agreement between experts and non-experts, the accuracy ranged from about 73% to 88%. We've also been working with a lab at Wageningen University in the Netherlands to validate the map globally on an annual basis. Now, as we've said, Dynamic World is not an annual map, so we've had to take annual temporal composites of the data. But Wageningen has created this global stratification that's independent of any land cover, so they can use it to validate all land covers and land cover maps, so we can compare across. This work is ongoing, which is why I'm not presenting results here, because we're testing out different ways to temporally aggregate the data. We're also working on regional monthly validation, so we're trying to get towards that near real-time component of it, where we've started with 3 different areas where we go in and take monthly composites of Dynamic World, and we take high-resolution imagery from that month and validate points. The results from this so far has really shown how the model performance varies in different geographies and in different times of year. All this to say, I'll just repeat again, that the most important thing to validate is the map that you're making and you're using with the Dynamic World product. So, but we're also very curious your thoughts, since this is like a new space of validating this very complex data set. So we would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. And that's it from us. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So next up, we have Aaron Trokim from University of Fairbanks, Alaska. If you can, speaking on transmission lines, so if you can transmit yourself out of the thicket.
Well, thank you so much for having me this morning. When we were sitting around in Fairbanks this summer talking about one of my projects, which is this one, I work with some finance people and some engineers, and we have this project, figuring out where transmission lines could go, especially in the north, which is a big deal for us. So transmission lines, when we talk about decarbonization, are really key component to especially decarbonizing in the north. Right now we have a very distributed electrical system, and we have relatively few electrical grids in comparison to the rest of the country, and I'm going to show some examples of that. And one thing that you should know is that, especially when you start building transmission, it is really expensive and a lot of planning goes into it. And right now, especially in northern regions, we have an abundance of renewable resources. And so there's a really good question of where do we locate our generation? How close is it to our population and our industry? And can we plan more effectively right now? And then I think like an ongoing issue is, are we going to transport at long distances out of the north as well? And in some areas of the world, we have been doing that. So it's a pretty big question that's been asked in a lot of the world, but we're starting to catch up. And so on the right, you can see a picture of one of our major transmission lines running from my house in Fairbanks down to the southern coast of Alaska. And this has just been upgraded over the last couple of years. And so now we're actually starting to talk about reversing the flow of power. So normally we had energy coming from the south coast of Alaska up north. And now we're talking about actually shipping wind energy south and reversing the flow of energy. And so there's some pretty interesting talks. And so when I started getting into this as a land use, land cover person, where it was a little bit more my happy place, there's a whole bunch of components that we have to think about siting. And so one of them is the generation. That one, when we think about that, we're thinking about a lot of marine energy resources, solar and wind. Then you have to have a substation to get it onto a line. And so there's a cost factor there. Then you have transmission lines, which are essentially high voltage electricity, 69 kV and up. That take power from the generation and take it to demand centers. And so they're really set up to minimize line loss. And so when we started this project, our goal was to test this idea that would it really be $1 million a mile for a transmission line? And the answer is it's not, actually. It's quite a bit more than that. So these are pretty key things to know. And then you need another substation, and then you have distribution lines. And so there's this whole ecosystem, as I like to call it, in thinking about the grid and thinking about how this interacts with land use, land cover. And there are obviously changes. And when we know and we can think about the fires in California, these are not abstract concepts at all, because a lot of the electrical grids are also, they're vulnerable to things like fire, but they can also start things like fire as well. And that also, they think that happened in Hawaii this past summer. So it's a pretty interesting question. We know we probably need more of it. Where do you put it? And how do you design the systems to be both resilient and cost effective? So I've been mapping these grids all around the world, but I'm just going to show you the North American version for today. And this is a map to show you how our grids are very isolated. So our regional transmission grids are in yellow. And then the big one that's not actually as interconnected in reality, but I make it look like that, is sitting down in red. So you can see that we have a number of grids, and you can see my home up in Fairbanks there. And they sit isolated, and they have for a long time. And so there is now a real question about, do we start to interconnect this and follow the law of spatial aggregation, which says that bigger systems are more stable. And so our little grids sitting up there are in theory stable, but maybe not as stable as the rest of the world. And so you see this pattern globally, actually, that a lot of these regional grids, which are also present in Australia and Africa, have been getting sucked up into the larger grids. And so the question is, what do we do? And so I put distribution grids on top of this just to have a little bit of appreciation for some of the data. So when you're doing this sort of work, there is not a lot of data. The data is not very good, and we're pulling a lot of it from a combination of OpenStreetMap, the utilities themselves, government sources. But if you're interested in this work, there's a real need for open data. And so the land use land cover is really key in having better predictive capacity in order to gap fill some of the needs that we have right now, which is that we don't totally know where all the lines are. We kind of do, but we kind of don't. So we're going to find where the lines are. So this is what we've been doing. We've been aggregating through a variety of different data sets, starting with the grids where we know where they are. Then we are using slope, things like road distance. I live up in the north, and so we have permafrost, which is perennially frozen ground with ice that gives us a lot of problems. And then on the end there is land use land cover. So what we're doing is we're building friction layers from all of these in order to then be able to calculate cumulative cost and eventually actual routing of where the lines are going to go. And so, and we're, I'm showing you a little test case, but we'll be applying this method to the whole Panarctic, actually, because it does scale, and it actually would scale globally if one were so interested in that as well. So it's kind of, it's a pretty interesting idea to aggregate a whole bunch of data sets. And so I just want to give a big shout out as well to all the people that produce all these data sets. It is very difficult to do this work without the production of like the land use land cover, the 3DEP data set by the USGS. There's a variety of things that go into this. So what are we doing? So this is where we're at right now. We have a small little test area that I've been like playing with. And this is looking at, there's actually a highway. It's called the Alaska Highway that runs between the top of the grid in green up there and then the bottom on the right-hand side there. And so you would assume that you should just run the transmission line down the highway. And when we look at the cumulative cost model on the right, and it's kind of matched up pretty well, you can see that if you take the shortest costs, it actually doesn't run along the length of the highway. It runs over the top, where there's also an additional highway, actually. So it gives us some real ideas about where to start linking the different data sets together. And then what we need to start doing is adding on all the communities on top of it. So the first order of business is to start linking the different grids together, and then we'll be doing the second step, which is then linking the communities to the existing grids as well as large-scale generation. So the land use, land cover is really key to realistic comparisons outside of the Arctic. So this has been done in the lower 48 forever. It's not particularly novel down there, I would say. But for us in the Arctic, we haven't had good land use, land cover data. And so it's allowed us to take a lot of the financial calculations and be able to replicate them in the north and then add on a few more of our key components, like the roads, which is really key for servicing the infrastructure and getting it built in the first place, and a variety of other things. And so if you want to talk to me more, I'd be happy to talk about this because I'm at the fun part, which is that I've been doing all the fun Earth Engine things, and now I have to rip the data out of Earth Engine, do the final cost path modeling, put the data back into Earth Engine, aggregate all the land use, land cover, the friction surface back out, and then we have another model for actually doing the cost calculations. And so there's still some like iterating to go. And when I was listening to all the machine learning people talk, I was like, wow, what I see, I think, is a real opportunity here is that after we go through this exercise a couple times, we should be able to automate a machine learning model to have to avoid all of this iteration and spinning through munging of large data sets. And so, so for a little take home for this, right now, is transmission line $1 million a mile in the Arctic? Nope, it's about $3 million a mile. That's what we're getting at right now. And so, it's an interesting time to be doing this project. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Aaron. So next up, I want to welcome William Ouellet. I hope I'm saying your name right.
almost. it's a tough one.
Cheers. My name is William Ouellet. It's like a W, basically, as if it was WW. I work at Epoch, which is a very early stage startup we incorporated in April this year. And we're basically focusing on helping supply chains, land-based supply chains, decarbonize through mostly the provision of analytics. We have a demo station, so please, to learn more, we'd love you guys to come and drop by and have a little demo for you. And I have another session about Earth Engine or Google like architectures also starting tomorrow evening, late afternoon. So would love you guys to join as well. So it's going to be a tale of dynamic world, but also segmentation sort of intermingled and combined. And I hope you guys will find it entertaining. So supply chains are nothing new. I mean, they've been around for a long time. They've been untraceable forever, for as long as we can remember. There were no satellites back at the time. If Da Vinci had come up with a satellite project, it would probably look like this one. That's what we can do now with these large language models. But basically, it's not technology that's actually solving the traceability problem, right? We have all the data we can wish for now in terms of satellite constellations to monitor pretty much every acre on the planet. But we are basically facing a problem where like suppliers have to actually collaborate to get this traceability. Luckily, we're basically benefiting from where we have regulations that are sort of blowing in our sails as data providers, that we can work in a sort of legislative or regulatory framework that allows us to provide this data in a meaningful way, to be able to say, look, we can plot your supply chain locations. We just need a bit of your help to like get it sort of georeferenced on a map, and then we can get going with calculating emissions from land use management and land use conversion. So we're going to talk specifically about soy today, just because it's kind of a bit of a landmark commodity in this space. Also, coincidentally, quite an easy one to monitor. I mean, the average plot size of soy is usually, anywhere north of 10 hectares. I mean, these are probably even hundreds of hectares in size, each of these plots. But importantly, I want to really, through this little visual, I really want to emphasize that the EUDR, for instance, is actually forcing the georeferencing of all supply chain plots companies who want to import in the EU actually have to do this work of, putting an actual location on their suppliers' plots. So that's really what we can start leveraging as service providers in this space. We're gonna look specifically at an area spoiling the story here. So this is an area in Tocantins in Brazil that we're going to be looking at. So one of the Cerrado areas where a lot of soy growing is happening, and a lot of native ecosystem conversion is happening as well. Why does it matter to basically tackle that problem specifically? It's that it's disproportionately responsible for basically the part of the supply chain which is the first mile, the growing of the commodity, and the clearance of land for that commodity is anywhere between 50 and 70% of the overall, emissions in that supply chain. So it's really, if you solve that problem, you solve the biggest chunk of the equation. And there's, of course, this regulatory push, which is helping, but it's not the full solution. And what we're trying to do as a company is help out some of these companies, whether they're commodity traders like the ones listed here, or consumer packaged goods companies, sort of get to compliance fastest and also get to working on reduction pathways. So, like I said, Tocantins, Cerrado, you see the land use change and the crop production is disproportionately, you know, large in the footprint of these supply chains. So the little test, the data experiments I'm going to show you today is basically sort of two stages with a lot of Google Cloud services intermingled. That's why this this session on the architecture that I have tomorrow gives sort of the, you know, the back end or the flip side of this talk today. But basically, we're going to use Dynamic World's temporal stack to the probabilities and use basically that change information to segment, to do some temporal segmentation and get a more change-centric segmentation of the landscape. It'll be very clear when I show you how it looks like. So we start with an area in Western Tocantins, which has a mixture of soy, both irrigated and rain-fed. This is what it looked like in the year of massively open online Earth observation. Like, that's around the year, at least in my sort of perception, where we started having this massive availability of, you know, constellation of data that is open, or at least that you can start playing with. So that was August 2016. Incidentally, also Sentinel-2 Dynamic World sort of time series starts around there. And we see how much the landscape has changed in that time span. We can also pull in some information of where the commodity is growing. There's a lot of amazing baseline or benchmark data sets for where commodities grow globally. So this is the University of Maryland soy data set, for instance, that I've pulled in. We can also start looking at cropping intensity. So this is the number of cropping seasons in that monitoring period. So between 2016 and 2023, like how many times have we actually observed soy in that location? And we can also map the bare soil frequency. There's an open source package that I recommend you guys take a look at if you're proficient with the Earth Engine, where you can basically extract bare soil pixels from time series data. And this is just counting the number of pixels that have been observed as bare in the time series, which is quite insightful when you're looking at land use management practices, because there is, of course, the time of the season where you grow something, but there's also the time where you don't grow something. Is the soil exposed in that period? Is it not? How long is it exposed? Is the plot double cropping? So it's common to have soy and maize, as a sort of double cropping rotation in these parts of the world. So this is the kind of very easy to extract information that gives you a bit more context on how intensively things are grown. We have also an above ground biomass product. This is really something we produce ourselves, but that is becoming commodified. I don't know if you've heard about Sea Trees as a data initiative, but they're going to do this way better than we can even do it. But for the time being, we used JEDI, of course, for training, the NICFI PlanetScope base maps, Sentinel-2, and Dynamic World probability stacks also added as covariates. So back to the previous presentation, you can start using it as covariates for calibrating and inferring above ground biomass. So you get a distribution of the biomass. That's another thing we can map out. You can also look at the beta diversity. I don't know how much, this is like a concept of landscape heterogeneity, where you look in sort of neighborhood operations, you look at the canopy height heterogeneity in the landscape. And we can see very clearly, like, this is completely unsupervised, right? It's just a neighborhood operation called the Rouse queue that's run on the raster. And you can see areas with low diversity, they're basically the soy fields. And you have varying degrees of, let's say, like diversity in the landscape. And of course, the boundaries between a field and a forest kind of spike up and show yellow. But it's a nice way to see how complex the landscape is, especially in terms of perennial biomass presence. So this is all, I'm showing you all of this because this is all information that ends up being used for the segmentation later. So there's I think there's actually a talk during the Geo for Good where Sean Voltman, one of the cloud geographers, is actually showing like a test where he's using phonology information. So this is phase, amplitude, and mean and DVI value used as part of a pan sharpening operation to segment the landscape based on phonology. So we did that as a first test. So basically ran his tutorial. That worked out really, really nicely. We get a segmentation of the landscape. We can then run some zonal statistics at plot level. But most importantly, this is nice, but we want to get sort of more change-centric. We want to use change data as inputs to the segmentation so we get more meaningful segmentation that is aligned with real changes in the landscape. So this is what we've been drawing out of the dynamic world stack. So you see a plot up there on the right-hand side that just basically shows the typical probability stack over time of a plot that got deforested for soy. So it's like a forest with a transition of like shrub and scrub, which is probably used for pasture, and then eventually becomes a soy field. And then you see also this is masked for statistical significance. So we only show the trends or the temporal trends that where we're kind of pretty like we have a high like 95% confidence interval that there's actually a positive or negative change that happened in those locations. And then you can start seeing a pattern coming out of the landscape. That then gets combined into basically a false color composite of dynamic world probability trends. And you see that this composite is actually a lot more change-lined. So the areas that actually pop up in color are change areas. And then that becomes the input to the segmentation model. Segmentation model, I didn't talk about it too much, but it's the geospatial segment anything model, which you, probably most of you are familiar with, the geospatial flavor of the meta segmentation algorithm. So then we get a segmentation, which is sort of, I mean, I masked out some parcels, but you get sort of a breakdown of where things are going. We started assigning some information that is useful for a commodity supplier. Or a supply chain for that commodity. And then we can start assigning emissions values to each of these polygons based on the stack of information I just showed you before. So maybe a few takeaways for the more sort of technical people in the room who are interested in reproducing such a workflow. Segmentation quirks, local tile contrast matter. The segmentation runs on a tile basis. And if you have a stark contrast in one of the tiles, so a water body, like a very large water body with land, you end up having just a binary segmentation, water versus not water. So that's just something to maybe think about. You actually see what's happening on the right-hand tile. The open commodity data is great, but there's definitely a need for producing sort of regional commodity like classification maps. I think there's a session on the last day about this, so I'm pretty excited to attend that one. And then the small perennial plots, which is not what I showed you here, like this is a very easy textbook case, Brazilian Cerrado, very easy to segment. But we've also done tests in places like Cameroon and, you know, for cocoa and other areas. It works fairly well to a certain extent, but there's obviously a very high uncertainty attached. There's a lot of missing, sort of omissions of segmentation. But it's definitely an approach that sort of gave me hope that this could be done for smallholder systems, like of very high like prevalence of perennial vegetation. And actually kind of looks like this. It's a lot less picture pretty. But yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, William. And now I want to welcome up Eric Lindquist from FAO.
Hi, everybody. My name is Eric Lindquist, FAO. Nice to be here and nice to talk to you. And today I'm gonna go try quickly through these, hopefully, so that we can have time for questions and answers, because I really think that that's the interesting part, too, about this. But I want to just, if you take nothing away from this talk, I want to let you know that, like, how we are making use of dynamic world, the pre-processed aspect of dynamic world, and the well-calibrated outputs of dynamic world and the probabilities of dynamic world, to leverage those to do things, to do other things. So it's a wonderful data set for that. So it's a wonderful data set by itself. It's also a wonderful data set to do things that you might have had to do in the past that you don't have to do now. And I want to talk about how we're using those to build customized data sets. at the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN. First thing is to classify NICFI and planet data. If you haven't heard of NICFI planet data, I hope you have, but if you haven't, you should hear about it and make use of it if you can. Free high-res data around the world is pretty awesome. And in our open source platform, free-to-use platform SEEPL, which is a combination of Google Earth Engine, Python R, other geospatial processing tools, and a nice user interface to kind of enable customized processing of geospatial data for doing anything you might want to do. Check that out at SEEPL.io. And then the NICFI planet data. Again, planet.com/NICFI. I'm contractually obligated to talk about the NICFI planet data. I feel like it has to happen at any of my presentations. So check it out. Free high-res data monthly. It's amazing. So let's see. So we use the 4.7 meter planet data. And this should start a video. This is some functionality in the SEEPL platform to create quickly a dynamic world composite over any geography that you're interested for any time period. You can select an asset recipe. You can query for the entire Earth Engine asset catalog for dynamic world. You can use any geography that you want in any time period you want, and can quickly create in this case, we'll be demonstrating sort of a mode composite of dynamic world data without having to code up how to use dynamic world. So our goal is to enable the most use of this data by the most number of people around the world. And this is how we do that. So some of this is new functionality. We're working it out as we go. The two developers, two of the developers of SEEPL platform are right there. Ask them about stuff. Complain to them. Anyway, so you can create a legend really quickly. And I want to get to the fun part here before I move on. And the idea, again, is to then use this data to, you know what, I'm just going to go forward because we don't have too much time. You can build a composite, and then you can subsample. We have applications to subsample from that composite that you've built. To generate training data or augment training data to classify other data sets. And this is important because in a lot of parts of the world, we don't have all of those classes that are available that are necessary to monitor, especially for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, all of those classes to monitor over time. And so with Dynamic World, we have that, but it may not be locally relevant in some cases. We're also using this in the planet context to improve the collection of agricultural and rural statistics, so we can make sure we're not missing areas especially of small-scale agriculture that are really important for local communities. So an example of that is, so when you do all of those things I just said, subsample and train, you can apply that training to the planet data on the left. This is dynamic world on the right. There's some things to talk about here, namely like maybe what local people consider local definitions of land cover are also important, and maybe there's a way to get at that through this process. But also the variability and the heterogeneity of the landscape can be perhaps better captured with the higher resolution planet data. It's just food for thought, basically. Some things we're trying with Dynamic World, and maybe you are too. I'm just going to go through these quick. Like I said, it's really important to be able to monitor these multiple land cover types, not just forest, non-forest, or some binary land cover classification, but to get at the how all of this mosaic of land cover is changing over time. So we're using that with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to hopefully produce at any two points in time that you want the changes in all of these land covers, which have, carbon stock implications as well, and then submit that or have that as a tool available for countries submitting their climate change reports to the panel. It's a work in progress, but it's in theory what we want to use. We want to use this dynamic world approach either through probabilities or otherwise or the class labels. I don't know if you know that. So every time sometimes you just throw stuff at the wall, see if it sticks, so to speak. And every time I do that, I think of this guy with the blender, the Will It Blend guy. If you haven't seen Will It Blend, it's a guy with a blender and he throws everything in it just to see if it blends. And I sort of feel like sometimes we do that with CCD or all these other algorithms in CCDC in this case. So what about applying CCDC to the probabilities of dynamic world? I just talked to William about that, and William said that Noel said that that was not a great idea, or why would you do that, which is always my worst fear of any time I mention anything about you could do this with Earth Engine. My worst fear is that Noel Gorlick is going to go, Eric, no. Anyway, we did it, or we're doing it, and so, and like, because why not? So in 15 lines of code or such, you get, like, essentially near real-time information on changes. So this is wildfire information in Canada this year, and that's just applying CCDC straight up to dynamic world probabilities, and you see already changes, massive fires from July 9th, August 18th. This was run, I did this yesterday, I think, so changes that are pretty recent and super easy to detect. So it does a really nice job, and we're checking in other places to see how well it does too there. And then finally, we're using dynamic world, the class probabilities, and in this context of spatial or sample-based area estimation as covariates to improve, sample interpretation and perhaps sample design so that countries can produce higher precision estimates of forest cover loss or forest cover change for the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change reports. All sorts of cool stuff. Some interesting links if you're interested in that. Yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
Great. Thanks so much to all of our speakers, to Ujjaval, Elise, William, I'm not going to try your last name again, Eric, and Aaron Prokim. There you are. The one thing I wanted to plug again, you've already heard a lot about it, but Valerie, maybe you can raise your hand up in the back. If you have questions about CloudScore Plus, she is your person. And you may be wondering what's next, and Wanda as well, and William, yes, the whole team, and Ollie. You may be, and Sean, oh God, you may be wondering what's next for Dynamic World and thinking, oh, okay, CloudScore, right? And we were very conservative in our cloud and shadow masking approach. It's not always right. You know, you can see some of these errors of omission in Dynamic World. We needed more signal, so we've invested in this CloudScore Plus, which is now an image collection. And we're looking forward to, it's at some point running it over Dynamic World as well. And this is Valerie's, I hope I'm not stealing your thunder for the session. This is Valerie's really neat CloudScore Explorer, CloudScore Plus Explorer. You can, and I'm going to plug your session. There's the session on Wednesday. You'll hear a lot more about it and understand how to apply it in your work much better. So the last thing I wanted to point to, I included a few slides, before we go to Q&A, is I wanted to plug three sessions, and there's probably more as well, at AGU, if you want to learn more and explore about Dynamic World and, continue to hear how other people are applying it for their work. And I also wanted to say, since we're a little short on Q&A, please, find any of the speakers here. We'll be here together for 3 days, so please make use of your time that's where you're all here in case you have other questions. Okay, so with that, if I could invite the speakers to the front, and please raise your hand. There's handheld mics in the back if you have any questions. And you can also ask them of the Dynamic World team as well. Any questions? We're all stunned in the silence. Yes. Thank you, Sean.
This would be, I think, Eric, for you, but for anybody. So I'm sitting here listening to this, and the first thing I do is I go to Dynamic World, and I look at an area that I'm very interested in, which is in Madagascar, and I discover that the classification fails pretty spectacularly in terms of recognizing bare earth and areas of erosion and gullying, which are the things I'm interested in. So now I'm really interested in this idea of training the data sets and learning how to do that. So my question is, and it's a terribly naive one, but as somebody who just started learning yesterday about how to work in Google Earth Engine, how would I start the process of trying to integrate this kind of training into ongoing research to better understand land use changes in Madagascar using this, but knowing that the data is flawed and I'd need to change it.
Does anyone want to jump on that? Yeah.
I can. Once you inert engine, the process is fairly straightforward. If you go to the user guide, and search for supervised classification using Earth Engine, there's a tutorial and video which shows you how to drop training points and assign a class and then train a model. And instead of normally they would talk about using Sentinel-2 bands or Landsat bands, you would use the dynamic world bands as input to your classifier. And that would retrain that model to produce a new land cover map. Yeah, and probably if you know what you're doing, it takes like less than 30 minutes to produce that map.
I was going to say, I actually wrote a blog post on this. I was looking at something very similar to you, landslides in Haines, Alaska, that went off in the winter, I believe, 2021. And what I found is that, yeah, the bare earth wasn't capturing these like very catastrophic landslides, but the disappearance of trees was, which was really interesting. And so I'm happy to forward that to you, and you can take a look. Yeah. Yeah, and then you can also compare weather data, which is what I was doing, actually. Yeah.
I just have a further on question to that question about to the dynamic world team in general. It's like, is there a procedure, or will there be a procedure in such ways that local knowledge can then be pushed back to the algorithm to improve the classification of dynamic world so that as you learn more, or as you improve that local classification in Madagascar, push it back somehow so that the next time it comes around, you don't have to do that, maybe?
Yeah, Ali or Val, do you want to speak to that? No?
It's a really good idea. We would have to figure out how to do the data sharing and you would be willing to share your knowledge back, but that is
anyway. Okay. Cool.
It'd be awesome. Yeah.
So I have a question. Firstly, thank you for the very fabulous presentations. Tons to learn and share. So, William, question for you. In your wonderful presentation, you showed commodity traders being your ultimate consumers. I'm just curious to learn from you your perspective of how they use your final outcome or your final product after you've run all of the algorithms. How do they use it?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So I guess emphasis on early stage. We're still figuring out a go-to-market strategy, but essentially, this would be a process to speed up your pathway to compliance as one of these companies. Usually, the ones that have the sort of pressure to act on regulations are the customer-facing companies. So we're trying to work with them first and foremost, and basically say that we have an EUDR sort of ready service. You can use this data. We help you speed up the georeferencing of your supply chain so that we can then, prove that it's deforestation free, but also further like along, which is sort of more complex affairs to calculate plot level emissions. And I was kind of didn't have too much time to talk about that, but we work with a combination of emissions factors and biomass, temporal biomass changes to get to some ballpark figure of the emissions. We basically serve that data in a compliance ready form, but also so that they can use this to like target better, like first give them sourcing optionality. If they want to source elsewhere, they get sort of a lay of the land of where the plots are more emissive or less emissive, and also give them the opportunity to sort of monitor and work on a reduction strategy. Yeah. So sorry, roundabout answer, but it's early.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
I think we've got time for one more question. Any takers, or people are hungry and want to break for lunch? All right, great. Thank you so much to our speakers. Really appreciate hearing from you.